Text 30. Muchukunda is expressing in this verse his eagerness to hear about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Not only for himself, but for the welfare of all living beings. In other words, his eagerness is that everyone, for all time and all directions, will understand who is Krishna. Ultimately, what is their relationship with Krishna? Because through his travels in this world, he has come to a conclusion that nothing else really has any true artha or value. The word artha is sometimes defined as value. Anartha means what really has no value. When we disconnect our consciousness from what is really valuable, then we fall under this illusion, Maya, of thinking things that really have little or no value to be of great value. The human form of life is rare. We take it for granted because we see so many humans all over the place, especially in Mumbai. There's something like 15 million people here. But what is 15 million? We can be very proud that this is so many. But how many bacterias are in you? Just your body. What to speak of all the bodies of all the people, of all the species of life. Wherever there's life, there's the presence of the Atma or the soul. There are 8,400,000 species that the soul travels through. And the culmination of this whole journey, going through the microbe, cellular, atomic little species, through vegetation of plants and trees, fish, insects, reptiles, birds, animals, and finally coming to human life. Human birth is actually rare. But most people in this human birth, they just want to enjoy physical and emotional pleasures, wasting the actual purpose of this life. Atato Brahma Jigyasa. This is extremely important because the Vedanta Sutra is the essence of all the knowledge of all the Vedas. Srila Vyasadeva, he compiled the four original Vedas Rig Veda, Atharva Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda. So many Upanishads, 108 primary Upanishads, many other Upanishads, many Puranas, 18 primary Puranas, the Mahabharata, Itihastas, Agamas. He and the great sages and rishis, they had provided so many various literatures to teach us how to live. Vedanta Sutra is the distillation of the essence of all this knowledge. And it begins with this proclamation. This means this, before even understanding what is about to be spoken in the sutras. This is the invocation. This is the statement to wake us up, so we take everything else seriously. And actually, unless we wake up to this point, we will not take our spiritual life very seriously. Atato Brahma Jigyasa. That now that you have taken this human life, which is actually so rare, it is time to inquire into Brahma, into the Absolute Truth. One of the ways that Maya deceives us birth after birth after birth is when she gives us something of value, artha, we don't understand its value. And therefore we chase after things, devote so much of our time for that which has no value to the soul. This human form of life is so valuable. But in Kali Yuga, because we see a lot of humans doing a lot of crazy things, we think, what is the use of this human life? We become depressed, we become suicidal, because we don't understand the value of this gift. The human life is actually only meant for one purpose, for self-realization. But we take it for granted. And then we crave for those things that were provided for us through all the other species of life. We want physical comfort. We want sensual satisfaction. We want some comfortable residence. We want to prove our strength. Yes? Whether it's sex life or wealth or power, all these mental and physical pleasures are available for the animals and for the birds. Some bird, the big birds, sometimes eat little birds. Yes? So what's so great about that? So big nations conquer little nations. What's the difference? The only difference is that birds are supposed to do that. But we're in total ignorance. That's why we do it. And yet we think we're so great. We make flags about it and everything like that. And write songs about it with our human intelligence. But actually, what's really what people are chasing after has very little value. They're available for the dogs and hogs and all the other species. But there's one thing that they cannot really pursue with full hearts, And that's self-realization, and that's what the human life provides. So how serious really are we? And if we're actually serious, it is expressed through our eagerness to hear, our eagerness to learn, our eagerness to serve, our eagerness to put our spiritual practice in the center of our life. Certainly we do have these bodies and we do have these minds, and therefore we have to tend to them. We cannot neglect them. Because if a human being, unless one is extremely liberated, anyone else, if they neglect their body and minds too much, then their spiritual life becomes unsustainable. Because the Atma is still so connected and still so identifying with the body and mind. Unless we're really experiencing that higher taste of ecstatic love or liberation, then we have to take care. But with our purpose in the center. Everything in our life is oriented in such a way to facilitate our journey home to the real self, to self-realization. And that is actual intelligence. Intelligence isn't simply about making deals in which you could make a lot of money or convincing people of whatever you want them to be convinced of or making incredible architectural designs that do not fall down during earthquakes. There's so many types of intelligence. But real intelligence is how to keep the real value of life in the center and somehow or other orchestrate and orient everything else we do for that purpose. This is what Bhagavad Gita is teaching us. Yat karoshi rasnasi yat chohoshi tadasya. Krishna tells Arjuna, whatever you do, do it as an offering to me. You have a family. You have a home, you have an occupation. Manmana bhavamad bhakto. But always think of me, always be my devotee. In other words, whatever you're doing should be as an expression of your devotion. And we should be eager to do that. Real tapasya doesn't mean austerity that because it's difficult, somehow or other, we get it done. Real tapasya is when we're excited and eager to do it because it's for Krishna. That means whether we're in military, like Arjuna, or like we're in business, or we're in farming, or we're in medicine, or whatever it may be, in the ashram, we're eager to do everything we do to facilitate ourselves and others to love Krishna. Muchakunda, he's expressing to Lord Sri Krishna that I am very eager to understand who you are. And I'm very eager for you to speak so everyone will understand who you are. The background to Muchakunda's eagerness is very instructive. He was a king. Not just a king. Today, you know, most of the kings and queens, they don't have much power at all. It's more or less symbolic. They get to, you know, preside over formal events. But it's mostly, you know, the political government that makes all the decisions and even tells the kings and queens what they have to do. But Mochagunda was a king of the Ikswaku dynasty. That's the dynasty Lord Ramchandra appeared in. It's a dynasty that has descended from Surya. Surya Narayan. It's a dynasty of, in many cases, completely liberated kings and avatars. And he was such a king that he had no rivals in his kingdom. He was so successful in his area that when the demigods in the heavenly worlds, the Swargaloka region, when they were being attacked and defeated, they were looking for somebody who could protect them. See, the demigods are very much like people who are doing strategic planning in this world. They look for a person who can get it done. They look for a person who in their area are really successful. So the demigods scanned the whole universe from Swargaloka down. Who in the world can protect us? And they don't need databases or anything like that. They have their own technology within their intelligence. And they found, here is Mochagunda. He's an unrivaled king on earth. He's the one who can help us. So Indra, they didn't just send, you know, some letter to Mochagunda. Indra, the leader of the demigods, approached him and said, "We need your help." What kind of a person is this? He's living comfortably. He has an unrivaled kingdom. He has no anxieties in that sense. And he's going to somebody else's place to fight against the most powerful warriors. Quite selfless. He agreed. Why did he agree? Because he's a devotee. He was praying to Krishna for devotional service. He was praying that I want to see you, my Lord. And knowing that the devas, even though they may have their issues sometimes of being entangled in material existence, they were doing service to the Supreme Lord. Because after all, the creation is Krishna's creation. And Brahma is Atmabhu. He's born directly from Lord Narayan. And he's given instructions of how the universe should be conducted. And Brahma, in the service of Lord Narayan, is creating everything in this world. And he's empowering, on behalf of Narayan, all these demigods to take care of important aspects of creation. Because nothing is ultimately impersonal. There's personal consciousness behind everything. And that's another way the Vedas teach us not to take things for granted. When we see rain, we just think, oh, the rain is coming because the clouds and because, you know, the atmosphere, different chemicals, or not chemicals, but different elements are mixing, you know, the ocean and the air and the humidity, and it creates, you know, clouds and it makes rain. And we just think like this. The heat, the sun, how we take it for granted. The sun's always there, it's just shining. But we need the sun, and we need the rain, and air. Every breath, we're surviving by the grace of air. And we just, in a very impersonal way, think air is there for everybody. If you have an asthma attack, you'll start appreciating air. But actually, the civilized Vedic culture teaches there's a person behind every one of these aspects. It's all ultimately being given by Krishna. But Surya, Vayu, Agni, they are on behalf of Krishna providing for us. So the worship of demigods is a very high culture in the sense that it's not taking things for granted. It's not taking things in an impersonal, ungrateful way. It's actually trying to reciprocate with all the different gifts on every level that we're receiving. And there are so many millions of 33 million demigods, is that it? And that's just in one little tiny universe. And they're all just trying to manage what Krishna has created. Yes? That's Krishna. That little cowherd boy who's being defeated in wrestling by his friends. He's created such a universe that it takes this many department heads just to keep it going. So when we honor the devas, what we're doing is we're showing that we're not taking things for granted. Things are personally giving to us, and we are personally showing our gratitude and appreciation. But Krishna tells in the Bhagavad Gita that because the devas, they are giving us material benefits. And even in our devotional service, we require those benefits to perform our service. So we should be grateful. But when we give honor because we want some material benedictions, then we miss the real purpose of the whole created universes. Devarshi Bhutaptinirnam Vitrinam. Krishna tells in the Gita that in the Bhagavatam, that just like the root of a tree supplies nourishment to every part of the tree, without a root, the trees cannot survive. I was recently in one place. It was near Washington, D.C. And there are very beautiful waterfalls. So some devotees, we went to the waterfalls. And on our way back, we saw this incredible tree. It's a large tree. It was totally hollow. It was just bark. It was just the outer shell and large tree. You could walk right into it. In fact, I did. With two other people. We were just sitting there chanting japa inside this tree. And you look up and it's just like a room. It's totally hollow. In the front of it, it's just air. There's nothing there. And on the three sides, although it's round, it's just the shell with nothing inside. And you look up and it's like that as far as you can see. So it's quite incredible. But then when I went outside the tree, I appreciated something I didn't so much before I went in. is the tree. It has millions and millions of leaves and flowers on it. It's completely healthy, fresh. Maybe not millions, but thousands. It was filled with leaves and some flowers also. And because the root was healthy, because the root is healthy, even despite losing everything else, it's still completely full of life. So Krishna is the root of all existence. And when you water the root, automatically that goes to every part of the tree. In the same way, when we serve Krishna, when we please Krishna, then all the demigods are completely satisfied. And all of our ancestors. And all those who we are indebted to. Because according to the laws of karma, everything we receive, we have a debt. But when we surrender to Krishna and give pleasure to Krishna, all our debts are completely fulfilled. Because Krishna is the root of everything. So the demigods, even in their abode, so many difficulties and anxieties. Abrahma bhuvana loka punaravartanojana mamupetita kontiya punarjanmanavidyate. From the highest planet to the lowest, all are places where there's anxiety. The devas are turning to a human king to help them. And Muchakunda, understanding the devas, they're doing Krishna's work. He left his family by his own free will and all of the comforts of his palace for Krishna's service. To fight against these asuras, don't even waste their time with kingdoms like Muchakunda's on earth. He was going to battle against them. And he did. And he was defeating them. As long as he was protecting the demigods, they could not be defeated. So when you have somebody good like that, you don't want to lose them. So the demigod just kept encouraging to continue to protect. So for a long time. And finally the demigods got their own person, Kartikeya, the son of Shankar. And then they went to Muchakunda and they said, thank you so much for all you've done. You've worked so hard for so long. Now you can retire. But we have to tell you this. When you retire, there's really no place for you to go that you know of, because you've been on our time zone. And in our time zone, what our 6 months in this world is like a moment for the demigods. So your wife, your children, your friends, all your family, all your palaces and wealth, everything has died long ago. But because you're up here with us, you lived. Just like the tides within the ocean, there is the tides of the waves. They wash away things on the shore. So by the power of time, Krishna, who says, Kala, time I am, everything is washed away. So after all this, now materially, he has nothing left. But the demigods, they give him benediction. Anything you desire, we will provide for you. Except we can't give you liberation, because we don't even have that ourselves. Only Vishnu can give liberation. So, how would you like to all of a sudden get that news? From the story, it doesn't appear that he was aware that everything was going to die while he was everyone that was dear to him. It's just being told to him at the end. Thank you very much. Now you have nothing left. But we'll give you any benediction you like. So Mukshakunda, he didn't sleep for so many years doing his fighting, doing his service. He was tired. Now, we all have this experience of what it means to really be tired. When you're really tired, nothing really has any flavor except sleep. Yes. I see some of you are exhibiting these emotions at this very moment. When you're really tired, like now, some of you are maybe falling asleep, but the thought that prasad, nice khichdi or whatever they're serving is coming after, then you're ready to wake up. But when you're really tired, even khichdi doesn't attract your... So Mukshakunda, he asks the demigods, just let me sleep. And give me this benediction that anyone who tries to wake me up is going to be burned to ashes. Now Mukshakunda is a very intelligent personality. He knows that he did a really good service for the devas and he was successful. So if anything goes wrong, they're going to come to him again. So he had his psychological way of preventing this from happening. If the devas themselves give him this benediction, they'll never bother him again. At least not when he's sleeping. So be it. And he went to this cave and went to sleep. How he slept. Long time he slept. And Krishna, who is Parameshwara, he's the supreme controller of all controllers. He understood the heart of Mukshakunda, and he wanted to reciprocate personally. Sometimes when we engage in devotional service and surrender in so many ways and we go through many challenges, we wonder, is Krishna really seeing us? Because, you know, where is he? I just want to go to sleep. Where's Krishna? But Krishna sees everything. He's within our heart. He's within every atomic particle. He's within the heart of every living being. He's within the sun, within the moon, within the stars, within the air. Krishna is everywhere through his energies. And he's personally receiving whatever service we do, especially when it is through his devotees. So we find in so many stories, Mahabharata, Ramayana, Srimad Bhagavatam, the lives of saintly persons, that oftentimes it doesn't appear that Krishna is personally reciprocating for a long time. But actually he is. He's personally reciprocating with us at every moment. And this is why it's so important to be eager to hear this message. To be reminded that Krishna is personally reciprocating with our devotional service at every moment. Ishvara sarva bhutanam hridayesh arjunatishti, from within the heart and from his eternal abode when we are engaged in Krishna, in bhakti. But our expectations of time are different than Krishna's. And when we come to the path of bhakti, we're actually entering into Krishna's time zone. And that's why a devotee should be enthusiastic and patient. Because if Krishna doesn't immediately manifest himself to us, he could. It's because out of his sincere love, this is what's really for our benefit. And for the benefit of those around us too. And to have faith in this is very important for our spiritual development. That any little thing we do, if we sweep the floor, if we cook an offering, if we distribute a book, if we speak Harikatha, if we offer a prayer, if we chant the name, Krishna's, if it's done with sincerity and devotion, Krishna is personally reciprocating. And it's an investment that Krishna will never forget, because Krishna is supremely grateful. But he doesn't reveal in a very personal way that reciprocation on a physical level that we may be able to sensually experience or even mentally experience. Immediately, because he wants us to understand the value. He wants us to take shelter in a deeper and deeper and deeper way through this apparent separation. So how did Krishna give this ultimate experience of himself to Mutrakunda? In his lila, he wanted to orchestrate so many different pastimes to harmonize for a particular purpose. So Mutrakunda is asleep in his cave, and Krishna is thinking of him while he's living in Mathura with the whole Yadu dynasty. Krishna had left Vrindavan some years before, and he was presiding in Mathura. And there Ugrasena was king. Krishna had already delivered Kamsa. Years have gone by. The residents of Vrindavan are crying in separation from Krishna. Every moment is like 12 years, like a millennia or more. Yugayatam nimeshena chakshusha pravrashayata. In nimesh, a 12th of a second, seems like yugayatam. Like a yuga. Hundreds and thousands, millions of years. It's not just a poetic conception. That's actually the feeling of these devotees who love Krishna in Vrindavan. And meanwhile, Jarasandha, Krishna is so intelligent, supremely intelligent. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya chuduskaram. He came to the world because he wanted to protect the pious, annihilate the miscreants, and establish true dharma. So he promised Bhumi Devi, Mother Earth, that he would relieve her burden. So Jarasandha, he was the father of the two queens of Kamsa. And even though Kamsa did so many atrocities to so many, he was so wicked, so evil. He imprisoned his own father. He imprisoned his own sister and brother-in-law. He killed so many people. He sent so many demons to kill Krishna. He sent Putana to kill every baby that was born in a certain time. What a mean person. Why? Because he just wanted... Because they were interfering with his material enjoyment. That's to the extent the false ego can bewilder a person. So his two daughters came to him and complained against Krishna. Our husband was so nice, and Krishna is such a rascal, he killed him. Jarasandha was very angry. He vowed to exterminate the Yadu dynasty as well as Krishna. So he attacked with 23 armies. An Akshohini division is an entire fully equipped army. He had 23 Akshohinis. That means 23 armies, and he was leading the way and attacked Mathura. Krishna and Balaram came out, defeated all the 23 armies, and then captured Jarasandha. And Balaram was about to do something to him. Krishna said, no, let him go. Krishna's plan was very strategic. That Jarasandha was so influential, all the demoniac kings from all over the world, he would gather them to attack Krishna. Because nobody could say no to Jarasandha. He was very senior asura. He was Kamsa was his son-in-law. That's quite an esteemed position. That means he was senior to Kamsa. So Krishna, instead of traveling all over the world to find these people, they were all going to come right to Mathura. And he did that 17 times. And every time, Krishna Balaram did the same thing. They delivered all the armies and let Jarasandha go so he could bring more... And bring more. 17 times he had been defeated. And now he was about to attack for the 18th time with 23 Akshohini divisions. Hare Krishna. So meanwhile, while he was making the plans and about to attack, Kalyavana was supernaturally powerful. He was beyond humans. He was he was born with such incredible yogic mystic powers. And he had an army of 30 million who were like him. No one could stand before. And he was especially born to exterminate the Yadu dynasty. So he and he was a yavana. He had no principles whatsoever except in other words, you know, killing and looting was just way of life for him. So he came to attack Mathura with his army. And Krishna and Balaram, they were thinking, Kaliyavana is on one side, Jarasandha is going to be coming on another side. So while we're fighting with Kaliyavana's army, then the citizens of Mathura will be subjected to the attack of Jarasandha. So what to do? Krishna created Dwarka with the help of Vishwakarma, but he empowered Vishwakarma to do it really fast. Yes? Sometimes we're proud of our construction. We get some professional company, and what usually takes in India 20 years, we do it in 2 months. We think this is very good. But what was constructed in Dwarka? Tens and thousands of magnificent palaces, each one better than Indra's. Yes, and beautiful parks and roadways. And it was all created in moments. Vishwakarma, he doesn't act like the architects in this earthly planet. He just has an idea, and then just by mystical powers it all is created. Krishna does through him. So the citizens of Mathura, you know, obviously with these two armies about to siege the city, they couldn't all of a sudden, you know, load their ox carts and their chariots and go to Dwarka. So how to transport them? Just like in our yatras, we want to go to Hampi, how to transport everyone? I think there's almost 5,000 devotees going. So many buses and so many trains and so many planes and so many cars and so many roads and so many bumps on every road. So it's a challenge. And that's just 5,000 of us. How big is the Yadu dynasty? So Krishna, when he wants to get something done, he does it according to his own will. We have a will, and then we have to somehow or other execute it. When Krishna has a will, it's executed. So Krishna built the city of Dwarka in the middle of the ocean, with huge walls around it to protect, but not like, you know, fort walls, beautiful walls. And then all the citizens of Mathura, they didn't know what was happening. They just thought it's like another day. They went to sleep at night, and Krishna transferred them, he transported them with all of their families, with all of their possessions, everything was transported while they were sleeping. So when the Brahma Muhurta hour came, the bells of the temples, the conch shells for Mangalartis and everything were happening, when they woke up, there they were, with their husbands, their wives, their children, all of their best possessions. They just walk up and it's all there in a magnificent palace in Dwarka. That's all. They went to sleep. They woke up. They were in Dwarka. Yes. Just like I think it's the August Kranti. I'm told you just go to sleep in Mumbai and you wake up and you're in Mathura. We are very proud of our railway system. But Krishna has his own railway system. So now there's nobody in Mathura. And Krishna and Balaram go out, and Kaliyavana's looking at Krishna, and he's saying all terrible blasphemies against Krishna, because that's the way warriors like to fight. They insult each other to exhibit their anger, and that kind of energizes them to fight more. And also, by these insults, the idea is their arrogance of insulting another is going to create some sort of fear in the other. So Kaliyavana is blaspheming Krishna. And Krishna just walks up to him. No chariot. No weapons. Just like very casually, Krishna just walks out of Mathura into the battlefield. And even though Kaliyavana was, according to these purports, a barbarian, that means he was very, very, violent person, he respected the codes of Kshatriya honor. And because Krishna was not on a chariot, he got off his chariot. And because Krishna had no weapons, he put down his weapons. He was ready to fight Krishna with his hands. And Krishna walked right up to him. Kaliyavana, fight me, fight me. Krishna didn't even look at him. Here is this. Kaliyavana was a giant. He was huge, and he's challenging Krishna with 30 million soldiers around him, and Krishna just walks by him. And he starts calling Krishna coward. Krishna just keeps walking, and he goes to grab Krishna. But Krishna's just not even centimeters away from him. He can't touch Krishna. Krishna didn't want him to touch him. So he's grabbing and grabbing, and he can't touch Krishna. Krishna's walking, and he starts running after Krishna. And he was really a fast runner. He had mystic powers. He could run, he could fly, he could do anything he wanted. He started running as fast as he could. Racing. And Krishna just kept walking. And he wasn't walking fast, he was just walking. Very relaxed. Now how is this? Inconceivable. This gigantic asura is running as fast as he can at Krishna's relaxed pace, walking, however fast he ran, he was always the same distance away from Krishna. Just not even an inch. He couldn't touch Krishna. He was getting so frustrated. He was running faster. He was so... His mind was stirring with anxiety. I have to fight this person. I was born to kill this person. And Krishna walked through the field, long distance, walked up a mountain. Kaliyavana is right behind him all the way. And Krishna goes in a cave. He goes into the cave, and it's dark. And he sees someone sleeping. This is the ultimate insult. I'm challenging this person to a fight, and he's not even looking at me. He doesn't even give any credibility to me. He doesn't even acknowledge my existence, and here I am, the greatest of the warriors. And now he goes to sleep. So he was very angry. And with all of his strength, he kicked this sleeping body, thinking it was Krishna. But it was Muchakunda. And Muchakunda slowly opened his eyes. It was dark. It took a few seconds for him to adjust to the darkness in the cave. Then he looked around. Looked to the right, looked to the left, looked up, looked down, and then he saw Kalyavana. And with much anger, he stared at Kalyavana. The fire element within the body of Kalyavana all of a sudden went really in a wild state. Because all of us, everything in material nature is earth, water, fire, air, and ether. That is the content of material, gross material energy. So we have the fire element in our bodies. And when we get sick, fever, sometimes that fire element, you know, increases. Oftentimes to try to burn away different types of diseased elements within us. But his fire element instantly set his entire physical body on fire. And within a second, all that was left of this great hero was ashes. So Muchakunda, after doing that, Krishna stepped forward. And he had four arms and a beautiful, beautiful complexion like a monsoon cloud and lotus-like eyes. And he had brilliant golden cloth around his body. And Muchakunda, in today's verses, is asking Krishna, who are you? You appear to be the supreme most of all humans. But he knew he was God. He had that realization. And he's saying, I am very eager to understand who you are. Krishna is giving him personal darshan. And then before Krishna even speaks, Muchakunda introduces himself and tells his own life story. And he explained in who he is. And Krishna, being very pleased, he says to Muchakunda that you are my devotee. I always reciprocate with the love of my devotees. You can ask any benediction of me. Krishna is offering him anything he wants. And Muchakunda is about to express his heart to Krishna. Krishna tells about himself. I'm sorry. He says, this is so beautiful. My dear friend, I have taken thousands of births, lived thousands of lives, and accepted thousands of names. In fact, my births, activities, and names are limitless. And thus, Even I cannot count them. Said, even after many lifetimes, if a person counts every particle of dust on the whole of the earth, they still cannot finish counting my qualities, activities, names, and births. O King, the greatest sages enumerate my births and activities, which take place throughout the three places of time, but never do they reach the end of them. This is a special feature about our Srimad Bhagavatam in particular, in our Vedic literatures in general. The concept of Sanatan Dharma. It's so deep, profound, and although infinitely concise, so universal. We find such an incredible understanding specific of the personality of Godhead. Shamsundar, his beautiful form. What his eyes look like, what his nose looks like, what his ears look like, what he's wearing. What his voice sounds like. Where he lives, what his abode, great details about the nature of his abode, what he does, what he likes. The Vedic literatures give such detail about the Supreme God and how that one Supreme God, who we understand so specifically, so personally, with such incredible detail, and it's revealed in this way because Krishna's all attractive. And just by hearing and meditating on Krishna in this way, our love awakens. We find little Dhruva Maharaj, when he was only 5 years old, Narada Muni described in great detail the form of the Paramatma, the Lord within his heart. And little Dhruva could meditate on that form. And through that meditation, he began chanting Krishna's holy names. He became completely pure and saw the Lord face to face. So while we're getting such a specific, incredible explanation and understanding of the personality of Godhead, his abode, his activities, his body and his qualities, we also learn that he manifests in incredible forms. Narasimha, Varaha, Kurma, Matsya, Ram, Narayan, Vamana. All these different forms. And these are just the prominent forms that we understand. But Krishna is explaining here that the amount of names that he has and forms and qualities that he performs when he descends into this material creation are limitless. How many particles of dust are on the earth? Even if you could calculate specifically how many there are, infinitely more is Krishna's names, forms, and activities. So Srila Prabhupada explained to us that this is such a great opulence because it could be so unifying. If you don't understand the essence, but you try to have a very universal concept, then it becomes nothing. just being universal without specific essence. But if we're just specific without understanding the universal nature of that specific, then you become very arrogant and sectarian. But in the principle of Sanatana Dharma, wherever we find the essence of the truth of what Krishna teaches in Bhagavad Gita, what's revealed in Srimad Bhagavatam and in these scriptures, we understand that that is true dharma. And that the Lord can appear in so many ways to manifest that true dharma. So within Sanatana Dharma, all the true religions of the world can be identified by the quality of what's actually being taught and what the realization actually is on the basis of the Vedas. And it's inclusive. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he understands that the Lord of all these, of Christianity, of Judaism, of Islam, of even Lord Buddha himself, these are all coming, being manifested by Krishna. And these are just a few of the religions that are around today, at this little era of Kali Yuga. But what to speak of within the whole creation? According to time, place, and circumstance, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata, the Lord appears. So we could love Krishna in all of these different forms because we understand what the essence is. Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote in one place, when I go to another religious person or another religious place where the Lord is being worshipped, even if I may not understand what's going on so much, I feel my beloved Krishna being loved and served by people in another way, in another form. That's Thakur Bhaktivinoda. And this is very much being confirmed here. And this is why the Vedic principles, the Vedic culture, is so necessary to be understood throughout the world. Because even people of other faiths can understand the universality by understanding the essence of who Krishna or who God actually is. And rise above arrogance and hatred. Krishna reveals himself to Muchukund in this way and then asks him, any benediction you like, please ask. I have come in this form as the son of Vasudev. Therefore, my name is Vasudev. Mother Earth, Bhumi Devi, along with Lord Brahma, called me to the earth to cleanse the world of the asuras and attract people to my loving pastimes. So this is how I have appeared today. And when he asks for a benediction, Mochukunda's reply he says, Krishna tells Mochukunda that in the past you have prayed to me, therefore I have appeared to you. Ask anything you like. Mochukunda tells, O Lord, the people of this world, both men and women, are bewildered by your illusory energy. They're unaware of the real benefit of life, which is to worship you, to love you, to serve you. And he explains that this is the only thing of real value. everything else will come and go. I have wasted all this time becoming more and more intoxicated in my domain and opulence as an earthly king. Each and every one of us is a little king of our own little domain. All men and women, whether it's a little house or whether it's a little straw mat in the street, whatever we have this tendency that I am the king of my little earthly domain. And we have to catch ourselves. I remember at one time I was sleeping. When I wanted to renounce everything of the world and seek God, sometimes I was in a jungle. And I'd sleep in a little cave or under a tree. And I sometimes caught myself. I would come and I would see some other sadhu sleeping in my cave. And I'd say, "What is this?" "My cave." Or it was a really nice flat spot under a tree, which is very rare in a forest, and see some other sadhu sleeping under the tree. Think, "What? He's under my tree." So in whatever situation, the tendency is we're the king of our own little domains. Yes? Muchakunda was actually a king who had a massive kingdom. But he's speaking for all of us. We're intoxicated by domain and opulence as an earthly king. With deep arrogance, I took myself to be the body. He says, he explains his realization. There's not much difference between his body and a pot or a wall. They're just different combinations of the same elements. The only difference is the soul happens to be in this little pot or wall. And we're thinking myself a god among men. I traveled the earth, surrounded by my charioteers, elephants, cavalry, foot soldiers, and generals, disregarding you as in my deluding pride. Says, but I did not understand that a man obsessed with these thoughts of I and mine doesn't see that God, in the form of time, is about to devour them. And even the body of the greatest beauty queen or king ultimately becomes either ashes or nourishes worms or becomes the excrement of those worms. That is the inevitable destiny of all physical bodies. And even having conquered all directions and even being free of all conflict, still, even the greatest conquerors of the world, they are all conquered by their senses and their mind. And then he comes to his conclusion. When in the material life of a wandering soul has ceased, O Achyuta, he may attain the association of your devotees. And when one associates with devotees, then devotion to Krishna awakens within the heart. Bhajahuremana Sri Nandanandana Abhaya Charanaravindane Durlabha Manava Janama Satsange my dear mind, please worship Sri Nandanandana. This human life is so rare, but the rarest, most valuable thing in all of human life is the association of devotees. Even attainment of all the eight mystic powers, the siddhis of the yogis, even attainment of liberation from all suffering, even attainment of elevation to the heavenly worlds, cannot compare to even a moment's association with devotees. Because none of these other things directly awaken devotion to Krishna from within our hearts. We should not take for granted the association of devotees. This idea of artha and anartha we're speaking of, what is valuable and what is really not valuable, comes from an ungrateful heart. We take things for granted. We take the human life for granted because there are so many humans. We don't understand the incredible value that we have in this human life. We take the association of devotees for granted because oftentimes it's so easy to have the association of devotees. Or there may even be a lot of devotees around. So we're thinking, so what? We deal with each other in very wasteful ways. Each moment is more precious than everything in creation. To hear about Krishna from devotees, to speak about Krishna to devotees, to serve devotees. More precious than anything in all of creation. And to the degree we actually appreciate that association, to that same extent, Krishna will reciprocate and our love for him will awaken. Our devotion will manifest. Muchukunda is appreciating that after wandering through this world in so many ways, and nothing else was really of value, not my chariots, not my elephants, not my palaces, not my powers, but the association of devotees is what awakened my devotion. Says the only benediction I want from you is to serve you. You are beyond the three modes of material nature. You are beyond the powers of time in this world. I only want to take shelter of you. Krishna was so pleased. Nadanam na janam na sundarim kavitam vaja kadisha kamaye mama janmani janmanishwari bhavatad bhakti rohaiti kitvai. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in his Shikshastakam prayer, he prays, I do not want wealth or beautiful opposite sex. I do not want fame or great knowledge. I don't even want liberation. I only want to serve you birth after birth after birth. It is the same prayer that Muchukunda is asking for when he's offered any benediction. I simply want to take full shelter of you and render service to you. Krishna, being very pleased, he tells Muchukunda, I only offered you material benedictions just to show how great you really are. And Krishna gives him such a benediction. He says, the minds of non-devotees who engage in such practices as pranayama are not fully cleansed of material desires. Thus, O King, material desires are again seen to arise in their minds. In other words, just by doing practices, if we do those same practices but with the desire for pure devotional service, under the guidance of pure devotees of the Lord, then the result is we don't want anything except to take shelter and to serve with love. And Krishna tells Muchakunda, wander this earth at will with your mind fixed on me. May you always possess such unfailing devotion to me. And then he tells King Muchakunda that through your life you will always be fixed in loving remembrance of me, wherever you may go. And in your next life, he said, you will become a Brahmin. An excellent Brahmin. And the greatest well-wisher of all creatures. And certainly come to me alone. This is the greatest benediction Krishna gives. While we are on this earth, that we can be the greatest well-wisher of all creatures. That means to inspire others to love Krishna. To see every living being in all species of life, all creatures, to see them in relationship to our own service to Lord Krishna. And this was the principle that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu put great emphasis on, and what Srila Prabhupada, our beloved founder Acharya, took as his life and soul. To be instruments of Prabhupada and Mahaprabhu's compassion, of being the greatest well-wishers for all creatures. And then naturally we come to Krishna alone. And of course it begins among ourselves, to be the greatest well-wishers of each other. That's what the Society of Devotees is. It's where we are really the greatest well-wishers of each other. And then as a family, we expand that well-wishing affection toward all creatures. Thank you very much. Kichuri is waiting for you. Hare Krishna.